You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Around 2.5 years ago, after weeks of protests that filled Tahrir Square, Egypt's longtime president, Hosni Mubarak, stepped down. In the months that followed, Egyptians worked to write a new constitution, elect a parliament, and then a president. But today, that constitution is suspended, that president, Mohamed Morsi, has been removed from office, and the future of Egyptian politics looks uncertain as the military maintains its grip on power. Joining me now for a look at what happened is Martin Smith. He is the writer and producer of Egypt in Crisis, which premieres tonight on Frontline at 10:30 locally on Channel 13. Welcome to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
And following the story in the press, I've gotten a sense of what's happened in broad strokes, but this report really filled in a lot of the important nuanced details for me. You had to throw it together very quickly. Was that a problem?
Well, we'd been there in January and February of 2011 and produced a program on the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was this sort of unknown factor in the so-called January 25th revolution.
Hadn't they kept a rather low profile?
They kept a low profile during that revolution because they were afraid that Mubarak would look at their involvement as some kind of conspiracy. And as he always did, Mubarak, he would use the Brotherhood as this sort of dark force that justified his repression. And he would speak to Europeans and Americans and say, look, I got to be tough because I have these, you know, he would call them terrorists out there ready to seize power if I don't keep a firm grip on things. So we went in with some experience on the ground. Charlie Sennett of Global Post, who is the correspondent on this piece, has went back several times over the last 2.5 years. So, yeah, it was quick. I spent July on the ground in Cairo and then all of August furiously putting this together and trying to sort through a very complicated story.
Did the Brotherhood also keep a low profile because it had a strategy to stay on the military's good side?
Yeah, I mean, as one analyst Khalil Al-Anani says in the program, the Brotherhood is not a revolutionary organization. They're very practical. And they saw their only path to power as not by sticking by the secular activists that had sparked and originally organized the revolution, but siding with the military, because the military is a strong player. And so they were very clever about sort of staying off the streets, sort of keeping a deal with the military junta that took over after the revolution and sort of sided up with them.
And is that when they started to make themselves more visible? Because they had said that they wouldn't even run a candidate in a presidential election if Mubarak fell.
They were very coy. They weren't, they said they would, their party would put up some candidates for parliament, but that they weren't going to involve themselves in a presidential race. And they reversed that very quickly and ran a couple of candidates. Morsi was really the dark horse. He was sort of, as they called him, the spare tire, the favorite to lead the Brotherhood. A fellow named Khaled al-Shatter was disqualified on some technicalities, and so Morsi stepped into the role of being their candidate.
The core membership of the Brotherhood is less than 5% of the country's population, and yet 52% voted for Morsi in the presidential runoff.
Well, the question is, did they vote for Morsi or did they vote against his opponent? His opponent, after initial series of runoff campaigns involving as many as 23 candidates, it came down to Morsi running against a former general during the Mubarak era named Ahmed Shafiq. And nobody wanted to go back in that direction. And so a lot of people went to the polls, held their noses, and voted for Morsi.
A number of other candidates had been eliminated. It was kind of like what happens in Iran.
Yeah, there were a lot of shenanigans being played. And by the time it gets down to the final runoff, Morsi's able to squeak by in a very close election. But some other very popular candidates. There were no candidates at the end. There was no candidate at the end that really represented the so-called revolutionary, the secular activists, the Christian community. Those people were really out in the cold.
So here's Egypt, which has been pretty much a secular country with some blips. It's elected a president from the Muslim Brotherhood, and more than 70% of the parliamentary seats have been won by Islamist parties. That was a rapid about-face for the Egyptians.
Yeah, this was a surprise, I think, to certainly a surprise to those young revolutionaries that organized the January 25th revolution, and that the Muslim Brotherhood was going to come to power controlling both the legislative branch of government and the presidency was unacceptable to a broad swath of the population, and including the military, which has been sort of watching from the wings this whole process. So they were not very keen on that. And 2 days before the presidential election, the Mubarak-era judiciary decided to disqualify or to close down parliament by saying that the parliamentary election was invalid.
Well, only 5% of the population belonged to the Muslim Brotherhood. But it's my sense from what you reveal here and from what's going on that there's a very strong Islamist feeling in Egypt, close to 50% of the population.
Well, it's an Islamic country.
There's one thing for it to be a country where people go to mosques and pray. There's another thing where people insist on imposing Sharia law on the country.
Yeah, well, a lot of people knew the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood was really the only organized force in the country outside of the government and the military and the police. And you have to go back and look at their history, as we do in the program. They're basically a religious movement, a social movement, and they run hospitals, they run schools, they have bread kitchens and whatnot. And so they have done a lot of grassroots organizing in neighborhoods across Egypt. And so when the vote came down, people were not necessarily voting for Sharia law. They were voting for a known entity known as the Muslim Brotherhood that, like any good political machine, knew how to get out the vote. And even though they're only 5%, it's very hard to get a grip on the exact, you know, card-carrying membership of the Brotherhood. But they have support that goes well beyond those sort of leaders.
There were attacks on the country's Coptic churches, which went unpunished by the military. In today's New York Times, there's an article about how there continued to be widespread support for Morsi outside of Cairo. There have also been a number of attacks on Coptic churches recently. Does the Muslim Brotherhood blame the cops for Morsi's ouster?
I don't know that the Muslim Brotherhood has issued any statement that would blame Coptic Christians per se, but they certainly have not rushed to the defense of the Christian community when it has come under attack from more radical Islamist elements. And you've seen over the years, during the Mubarak years and into Morsi's time in office, and certainly during the military rule, the 18 months after the revolution and before Morsi's election, you saw a steady rise in the number of attacks on churches. The Muslim Brotherhood did not go out of its way to criticize these attacks. That community then saw a whole rash of churches burned after the August 14th massacre at the mosque that was the final clearing of the mosque in August by the military. You saw a whole rash of church burnings. The Coptic Christians are have been increasingly fearful and are especially fearful now. They've lost a lot of their churches. And this is a group that's been practicing Christianity there since the beginnings of Christianity.
Well, has the unrest just simply unleashed all sorts of anger among the Islamic part of the populace to go after the cops, to go after anybody else who they have held long-term resentments against?
Well, yeah, and they've been handed the high moral ground by the ouster of Morsi. Morsi was, whatever you make of his time in office, he was democratically elected. And by ousting him, even if it was a popular removal, they see it as nothing less than a coup, and a lot of there's a lot of anger among Islamists, Muslim Brotherhood supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood leadership, legitimate anger that they've been unfairly removed.
I'm talking with Martin Smith, who's the writer and producer of Egypt in Crisis, which is being reported by Global Post correspondent Charles Sennett, and premieres tonight on Frontline at 10:30, locally here on Channel 13. What is the deep state?
Yeah, the deep state is a term that Egyptians used that refers to the sort of elements, the surviving elements of the Mubarak regime or of the, you know, 60 years of dictatorship that they've had, 30 under Mubarak most recently. And that would include the state-run media. That would include the judiciary, judges that were appointed by Mubarak. It would include all the state security institutions, including the military, really at the very top of that that pyramid. And when Mubarak was overthrown by the revolution of January 25th, what you really had was a decapitation of the state, but not the death of the state. The state remained there.
Although it did adjust a bit, I remember that many people in the media apologizing for the way they had reported the story of the protests, which had been very much pro-Mubarak. So have things changed? What's happened to the deep state?
Well, the deep state is still very much in charge. It's the deep state that closed down parliament. It's the deep state that moved against Morsi. The military is, I think, very much they're struggling somewhat. I mean, the piece that you mentioned before in the Times today about unrest in the countryside from support for the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, this is going to continue for some time, but they've shown no reticence to come in with force and put these demonstrations down.
Didn't Morsi pick General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to head the armed forces?
Yeah. I mean, his predecessor, General Tantawi, was on his way out. He was getting up in his years, and he was going to retire, as were a number of generals. So Morsi took advantage of that situation, and he brought in the former head of Egyptian intelligence, el-Sisi, and he thought that he had an arrangement with him whereby if we, the Brotherhood, if I, Morsi, don't mess too much with your power, with your businesses, because it's important to understand that the military in Egypt is not simply a military like we understand our military, but they're big business. They own as much as 40% of the economy.
So similar to what happens in Pakistan and in Russia.
Yes. But it's not a model I think most Americans are sort of intuit. But it is, yes, very much like Pakistan. So the military wants to protect their perks, their businesses. And the military would very much like to see the economy get back on track. I mean, right now, tourism is down to almost nil. These guys that are in the military depend on the sort of traditional economy functioning. And so they made a deal with Morsi that they would stay out of politics if you stay out of our business and don't go after us for all the crimes committed during the Mubarak era. That was the initial deal.
It's similar to what happened with Yeltsin giving Putin a prominent role in his government, and look what happened there. So I guess they should have watched what happened in Russia. One of the people you talk with, Mona Makram, is it Abid?
Mm-hmm.
She's a professor at the American University of Cairo. She says that in the film that Morsi was no Mandela. So how did Morsi respond as protests continued after he was sworn in? Was he using the same tactics that Mubarak had been using for years?
Yeah, he very much adopted the Mubarak playbook and used repression. The revolutionaries of January of 2011 had continued to protest in Tahrir and in other squares in Cairo and other cities calling for justice, calling for people in the security services to be held responsible for torture, unlawful detentions, and whatnot. And they were getting crushed continually under Morsi as well. So there was no sense from the people that had sparked that revolution that they were making any progress. Morsi betrayed that revolution in their view.
And then a little less than a year ago, last November, President Mohamed Morsi issued a declaration that gave him the power to take any and all action that he deemed necessary with no check on his power, in essence placing him beyond the reach of the Constitution. Was that a turning point for many Egyptians?
A huge one. That's what everybody cites. And it's a little hard for people to grasp exactly what was going on there.
Mubarak had never attempted anything like that.
No, this was well beyond what, as one of our interviewees, Khaled Fahmy, also of the American University in Cairo, says, this was way beyond anything Mubarak had done. And as he puts it, this guy could no longer be my president. And so that sparked a petition that eventually sparked the overthrow of Morsi. But it was all about taking on powers that he felt were going to be taken away from him. Well, let me put that better.
This was a kind of preemptive strike?
It was a preemptive strike. The judiciary, again, many of them Mubarak-era judges, were set up to rule on whether the Constituent Assembly, the body that was writing the new constitution, was legitimately representative body. It was heavily packed with Morsi supporters, with Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists. And Morsi was worried that the judiciary was going to close it down, so he just ruled that he had powers above the judiciary.
And there were reasons to be concerned. Some of the Constitution dealt with women's rights, and it actually eliminated some of the rights that they've had all these years. It definitely made the country more religious. It relied on Sharia law in many cases. And not only you mentioned the petition from a group called Tamarid, which means rebel. They start collecting signatures. Also, a quarter of the Constituent Assembly resigned in protest. How many signatures did they collect?
They claim that they collected 22 million signatures.
Well, how large is the population of Egypt?
Well, the population is a little over 80. But if you look at the electorate, it's probably somewhere around 50. So you're talking about almost half of the electorate having signed these petitions.
And did Morsi pay any attention?
They didn't take it very seriously from all accounts and were stubborn. They went forward with their Islamist project. Churches continued to be burned. There were a number of incidents around the country that gave everybody an indication that Morsi wasn't backing off, that he was moving forward. And so they called for a nationwide demonstration for June 30th of 2013, very recently, and asked for everybody to come out in the streets. And on that day, the numbers we don't know, but it's said to be perhaps the largest demonstration anywhere in human history. It was far larger than the January 25th, 2011 revolution. So the military was very worried about what might happen next.
Didn't President Obama call Morsi and say maybe you should back off a bit?
Yeah, the Tamarit had made a series of demands. They wanted more inclusion in the government, and they wanted Morsi. The principal demand was that he step aside for early elections. President Obama calls him, has trouble getting through to him, finally gets through to him, talks to him, and is not able to convince him.
One of Morsi's advisors appears in the film. Did he explain why Morsi was seemingly unaware of how tenuous his grip on power was, or why Morsi wasn't receptive to either General el-Sisi or to outside pressure or to the United States?
Morsi believed he had this deal with General el-Sisi that was struck really in the early days of his presidency. And he knew that he was facing an uprising. He knew that he had a lot of disgruntled subjects, that people were in the streets and unhappy. But he didn't think that the military was going to join with the people and overthrow him.
The Muslim Brotherhood organized a counter-protest at the Rabah al-Adawiya Mosque. How close was the country to devolving into civil war?
We were there during those days. That was all throughout July, and it was a very tense time. There were demonstrations that sort of flash mobs would crop up every couple of days. Rock throwing would devolve to snipers, police sniping at people. There were a lot of deaths. So in some sense, there was a civil war going on at that time.
Well, it sounds like it's a three-legged stool. In fact, we had on the show, we had Time Magazine's Ashraf Khalil and the Wall Street Journal's Charles Levinson. They were here last month to talk about the situation in Egypt. They described the country's politics as a three-legged stool with the military, the secular parties, and the Islamist parties, including the Muslim Brotherhood. But you get the feeling the military has the largest leg on that three-legged stool.
I think that they've been babysitting this whole process. And, you know, unlike in Algeria, where the military didn't even allow the Islamist parties to successfully take office, they allowed, in some sense, in Egypt, for the Muslim Brotherhood to win the election, but they weren't willing to sit by very long and let things bubble along. Once they saw, you know, tens of millions of people, or between 10, let's say between 10 and 20 million people on the streets on June 30th, that was it for them. And they, you know, Morsi gets from Sisi a 48-hour ultimatum. Either you comply with Tamarit's demands that you step aside for early elections or your history.
And his response was similar to what Hosni Mubarak had done just 3 years earlier.
I guess you get pretty insulated inside that palace and don't believe or believe that your only course is to just stand pat and face the music. And that's what he did, and they came and removed him. He's now in prison.
But they did more. In the weeks that followed, the military violently cracked down on the Muslim Brotherhood protesters who were outside the Rabah al-Adawiya Mosque. How much support did the Brotherhood have at this point? Were people surprised? Were the secular people surprised when on August 14th, 600 people were killed as the cops came in to break up the protests? That was a particularly brutal crackdown.
Particularly brutal. Very brutal. Most of these protesters were unarmed. There were a lot of women and children. That's not to say that there weren't Muslim brothers who had guns of one kind or another, but the vast majority of them were unarmed. The military blocked exits from the square, and the police came in, positioned snipers, and just took people down. You see the footage in tonight's program is very disturbing, what you see there. Hundreds were dead, thousands wounded by the end, and it sparked a whole new round of violence. Sisi had said that he was going to have an orderly, humane dispersal of the square, but these security forces in Egypt seem not well prepared or trained for that kind of crowd control. And so it only takes, you know, one squad leader to decide to open fire, and the whole thing devolves into mayhem, and that's what happened.
Because of the military aid involved, the Obama administration was very cautious about whether to call Morsi's overthrow a military coup. But it was a coup, wasn't it?
Well, it was a coup. It was a popular coup. And I guess those two, that's something of an oxymoron. Usually a coup is when the military just moves in, regardless of what it is that the people are expressing they want. But this was clearly a case where the country was being paralyzed, destabilized by these mass protests. And so the decision of General el-Sisi to move in and pressure Morsi for President Obama as well at the 11th hour to call Morsi and ask for him to consider Tamarad's demands. It was a very unstable situation.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood spokesman said, you know, we can't live this way. You have an elected government. It makes some decisions that are unpopular with a portion of the populace, and then you just throw the guy out. You have a coup, and then you do it again. That makes any government unstable.
I think that's a very reasonable argument. So notwithstanding the fact that things were unstable, there could have been, and I think this – I mean, let me not give my opinion. Let me say that those secular activists who are now in bed with the military because they were calling for Morsi's ouster, but they did not want to see this go through this process of a military ouster or military coup. They wanted early elections. They wanted pressure that would have continued for days. In fact, it was on June 30th that people massed in Tahrir and around Egypt, but it was on July 3rd that the military moved in and removed him. So there was no time in there.
General El-Sisi declared a month-long state of emergency, which he extended last week, citing security concerns. The military and police have expanded powers right now. Is the political process completely stalled? We have a situation here because in watching this film, where you spoke to people from all across the political spectrum, the sense I got was that this situation is nearly irreconcilable, with the country split almost 50-50. Do you have any sense of how Egypt is going to get past the situation other than to maintain a tight-fisted military dictatorship into the future?
It's a hard one. You really have to trust the military to shepherd this transitional process, and they haven't done this in the past, and there's no real indication. I don't have a lot of faith. I find it a very discouraging situation.
So El-Sisi could easily be the next Mubarak?
Well, he has shown signs of political ambition, and he's made calls for people to come out in the streets in support of him. Why is he making those calls? Why aren't those calls done by the civilian leadership that you never hear about? It's always El-Sisi is calling the shots.
Martin Smith is the writer and producer of Egypt in Crisis, which premieres tonight on Frontline at 10:30. Locally here on Channel 13. It is reported by Global Post correspondent Charles Sennett. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, thank you.